Good morning. Please turn in your New Testaments to Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17. This past week in the Target Bible reading that we've been doing, we read through chapters 15 through 19, and there was a lot of great things in there. I love preaching from chapter 18. I think there's some great stuff there. But there were some things in chapter 17 that I was reminded of, and I thought, you know, we'll cover that in the lesson this morning. If you're not familiar with that text, the first part of chapter 17 records Jesus taking three of his disciples up on a mountain, and Jesus being transfigured. We're not exactly sure which mountain that was, but they refer to it as the Mount of Transfiguration. And what the word transfiguration means is to change. While they went up on that mountain, the appearance of Jesus changed. And what we'll do this morning is we will take lessons from the mountaintop. There are several things through the chapter that I think tie together and make some pretty powerful application, and I'd like us to consider 5 points from this chapter this morning. Let's read the first 8 verses of Jesus and his disciples going up. Starting in verse 1. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah, talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Rise and have no fear." And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. There are a couple of different locations in Israel where they suspect that this event took place. There's one a little bit further south. There's actually a chapel that's there called the Church of the Transfiguration. There's also another location, Mount Hermon, a little bit further north, which kind of gives you a much grander perspective. Consider Jesus going up onto a rock face like that and something like this happening. They go up there, and Jesus' face starts to shine. And the way Matthew describes it is, it shone like the sun. It makes me think about when Moses, after going in to interact with God, would come back out and his face would be shining because he had been in the presence of God. And the people of Israel couldn't stand to look at Moses' face after that, so Moses would veil his face so that they wouldn't see how bright it was. These three men see Jesus' face shine, and it's not because he's reflecting the presence of God, it's because he is God. They're seeing something of the divinity of Jesus shining through in his humanity, and his clothes, in verse 2, became white as light. And if that weren't enough, Moses and Elijah show up. Now, we could do a whole sermon just on this point, but think about this for a second. Where was it that Moses wanted to go so badly during his life? Into the promised land. When was the last time we remember reading about the physical presence of Moses? On a mountaintop on the eastern side of the Jordan. And here we are during the life of Jesus, and Moses finally puts his feet on the western side. That's just something to think about. But you have Moses, the recorder of the law, and Elijah, one of the most well-known prophets, so representing the law and the prophets, interacting with Jesus. And Peter, doing his very typical Peter thing, starts to prolong this and just starts talking Lord, it's good that we are here. If you wish, I'll make you three tents. And if you can't figure out who they're for, there's one for you and one for him and one for him. Like Jesus doesn't know math. And he doesn't even finish the sentence when a bright cloud overshadows them. Now think about how bright that cloud must have been, because Jesus' face is already shining. His clothes are already bright. And then the cloud shows up, even brighter than that. And from that cloud you hear this voice. This, not Moses and Elijah, this one is my beloved son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. This is not the first time that God has affirmed his relationship with Jesus. You remember during his baptism, God affirmed, this is my son. But he affirms it here not too long before he goes into Jerusalem and is arrested and crucified. And what he tells these disciples who are all excited with Moses and Elijah is he tells them to listen to Jesus. Jesus, who perfectly kept the law and perfectly spread the message that God wanted him to spread. They want him to listen to Jesus. There's a point that we typically make from those eight verses, and I think it's right to make them. The first point that we'll make this morning is that God was wanting those disciples to willingly submit to the Son. Yes, it's impressive that Moses was there, and Moses was the giver of the law. Jesus explained on the Sermon on the Mount that he came to perfectly keep and fulfill the law. But even though Moses was standing there, they were supposed to listen to Jesus and submit to Jesus. And you had Elijah, one of the most well-known prophets who had done some incredible miracles. Even though that prophet was standing there, Jesus trumped Elijah. And so God, affirming his son and how pleased he is with him, says, listen to Jesus. And it's when they heard that voice that those three drop on their faces out of reverence for God. And Jesus comes and touches them and brings them back up. And when they finally lift their faces back up, Moses and Elijah are gone, the cloud is gone, and everything's back to the way it was. But you realize, as you go through the Gospels, and as you're considering who Jesus is, that every single one of us are issued the same challenge. As we consider who we're going to follow and what influences we're going to allow into our lives, God is saying, I have a beloved son, listen to him. Submit to him. There was someone that I was studying with, and we were going over the gospel, and we were talking about conversion, we were talking about becoming a Christian, and that was the critical point. There was so much that they understood about their relationship with God and where their sin had put them. There's this great gulf between them and God. They understood that Jesus had come to atone for their sins, pay their debt, remove all of that. They understood all of that. They understood their need to be buried with Jesus in baptism. They understood all of that. And when it came down to, so are you ready to do that? The answer was, I don't know if I'm ready to make Jesus my Lord. That is an honest statement. Because what that statement reveals is the person understands that by becoming a Christian, by accepting that atonement and accepting the grace and mercy that comes through Jesus, that you are saying, I'm going to listen to him. The way Paul says over in Romans chapter 6, I'm no longer going to live and be a slave of the flesh. Instead, I'm going to enslave myself to Jesus. Jesus will be my new master. And that's what God is calling those three men to. Listen to Jesus, my beloved son. But he doesn't stop there. Let's go on in verse 9. They're coming down from the mountain. And Jesus commands them, tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Now I'm going to just chalk this up to, this was already a supernatural day. Their senses were probably on overload. They were probably trying to sort through everything they had just experienced. And you think about what Jesus just said. They're coming down, and Jesus says, tell no one the vision, don't tell anyone about what you just saw, until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Now, we're just so used to that fact, Jesus was raised from the dead. But he just told them, I'm going to die, and I'm going to come back. And on a calm road trip where nothing else is going on, if someone were just to make that statement, you'd go, wait a minute, you're what? But the fact that he had just predicted his resurrection is not what they caught. They go to, then why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? They totally missed the point. And so he humored them. He answered, Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come. And they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. And so he brings it back around. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Just like John the Baptist was hurt, I'm going to be hurt. But I'm going to come back, is the point of the paragraph. Do you realize the significance of verse 9? This event happened and there were four people there. I mean, if you count Moses and Elijah, six. And Jesus says, we're going to keep this a secret until after I'm raised from the dead. We're reading about it, which means it's no longer a secret, which means what about Jesus? He was raised from the dead, which freed up those three men to tell everybody what they had seen that day. And Matthew records it, and we get to read about it. The fact that we read about the transfiguration is evidence that Jesus was raised, because they weren't supposed to talk about it until after that. But what's so significant about that? The resurrection is such a central part of the gospel story of Jesus. I mean, if he was not raised, what hope do we have? If he wasn't raised, there was no point in everything that he did. It's actually the hope of the resurrection and our future hope that we're supposed to bank on. Over in 1 Peter, 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13, Peter writes, therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. You set your hope fully on that day of future grace when Jesus comes back and we get to be with him. Where we get to be raised because he was raised. Do you realize that this whole event gave Peter a really unique perspective? It gave him a really unique perspective on the resurrection and the hope that we have. Consider 2 Peter chapter 1. Peter is trying to help his audience understand that what the gospel that they preached was based in fact. It wasn't something made up. It wasn't a story. It wasn't legend. Peter says in 2 Peter 1 verse 16, we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. But we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For when he received honor and glory from God the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased, we ourselves heard this very voice born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain. When you go back to verse 16, he's talking about the coming, the second coming of Jesus. And he says that that day on the Mount of Transfiguration, when they saw Jesus changed, was like a foreshadowing of the day when he's going to come back in all of his glory. It was like a foretaste of that. Imagine watching Michael Jordan play basketball in high school. He's not at his peak. He's not in his prime, but he has skill. And every now and then you see him perform a move or be successful at a shot, and you're like, wow, that was something. And if you had been in the gym that day and had watched him play, and then a couple of decades later seen him at his peak, you would have said, I could have told you that was going to happen. Because back here, there were inklings at his skill and inklings of how good he was. And that's what Peter does with the Mount of Transfiguration. He says, I had a glimpse of what it's going to be like when Jesus comes back. And because I saw that glimpse, I'm confident this is going to happen. And since I'm confident it's going to happen, I'm going to tell everybody. Because I want everyone to be confident in the return of Jesus. So back in Matthew 17, what Matthew is trying to get us to do is to anchor our hope in the Son's resurrection. He is going to come back because he was raised. And we have hope in that. Now, do you remember back in the Old Testament, when Moses goes up on Mount Sinai, he's receiving the law from God, and he comes down from the mountain? When he comes down from the mountain, it was not a positive thing. He came down because he heard the Israelites acting out in unbelief and a lack of faith and in a sinful way. Jesus comes down from the mountain, and notice what he finds in verse 14. Just like Moses, when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and kneeling before him said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and he suffers terribly. For often he falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him." But Jesus sent his disciples out to do just that. I mean, at one point, Jesus sent out 72 disciples to heal people that were hurting, to demonstrate that the kingdom was coming. This man came to his disciples to have done what they've already done in other places, and they were unable to do it. And they were confused. In verse 17, Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." And then some of your translations will continue to say, "But this kind never comes out except by prayer and fasting." What's going on there? Why were they unable to do what they had previously been able to do? And why was Jesus so harsh when he says, "O faithless and twisted generation"? That's actually directed at his disciples. When he asks, "How long am I to be with you?" That's for his followers. I think the answer is at the end of verse 20. Partly in that phrase, "This kind never comes out except by prayer and fasting." You know when you do something that is brand new, you're nervous? Your muscles kind of get tight. You want to do it perfectly, especially if it's a public deal. People are watching. You know, there's pressure to perform. And once you do it a handful of times, you start to get used to it. You start to relax. And you start to do it a little bit more. And after a while, it just becomes old hat. It's like second nature. The thing that once you were so nervous about, you just do nonchalantly. Like the first time I helped serve the Lord's Supper, I thought for sure someone was going to wear that grape juice. For sure. And as they gave me that tray, my brothers teased me all the rest of the day. You could hear the cups. Because I was holding them. Been doing it for decades and haven't dumped it yet. And I don't shake anymore when I hold it. Now what that means is pride goes before a fall, and one of you is going to wear it one of these days. But the point is, we get confident. And we get confident in ourselves. And in our ability, and in our wisdom, and in our strength. And you have these disciples that Jesus has sent out. They have been doing this for a period of time now. And what Jesus' rebuke reveals is they had gotten to the point where they had stopped forgetting they were doing this by the power and the instruction of Jesus. And so when you get that last phrase, "This kind never comes out except by prayer and fasting," what did prayer and fasting require? Humbly leaning on provision other than their own. They had become self-reliant instead of consistently relying on the Son. Jesus is trying to help his disciples realize you need constant contact with me. You need to constantly be turning to me. You need to constantly be communicating with me. And if you don't, you're not going to be able to do what I've called on you to do. Let's move forward to verses 22 and 23. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. And they will kill him, and he'll be raised on the third day." Again, he tells them about his crucifixion and resurrection. He gets even more specific by giving them the time frame, the 3 days. And their response was they were greatly distressed. Now, we're going to make a slightly different application than I think what the text is emphasizing. I think what they are wrestling with is the distress that their perception of the Messiah does not match up with what the Messiah says is going to happen. They think the Messiah, they think Jesus, the Anointed One, is going to become this earthly king that rules from Jerusalem. Their concept of the Messiah does not involve crucifixion. And they're distressed over that. However, I think there's an application that we can make from verse 23, and that we need to be distressed over the fact that Jesus was crucified. When you understand exactly what Jesus was doing during the crucifixion, we ought to be distressed over that. I mean, that's the point of Matthew chapter 5 when he says, "Blessed are those who mourn." We need to mourn over the fact that the Son of God was required to die to pay for my sin. I mean, when we read through the first several verses of Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, and we read about what that servant bore, he carried my sorrows, he bore my griefs, he was stricken for my affliction. I need to grieve the fact that I've caused the Son of God that amount of pain. I should mourn the fact that I'm hurting the Son. And if we understand the enormity of that, then the next several verses are just really powerful. Starting in verse 24, "When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, 'Does your teacher not pay the tax?' And he said, 'Yes.' And then when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, 'What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?'" And this is just, we'll stop just here for a second. I'm amazed at how well Jesus uses every opportunity available to him to teach. I remember growing up, when my dad was doing taxes, you don't go in that room. When he's sitting at the dining room table with all the papers and all the receipts and all the forms, you don't bug dad until he is done. Peter goes to Jesus and it's time to pay tax. And Jesus uses tax season as a moment to teach. It was just amazing. And Jesus is the one who initiates. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you'll find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." Jesus makes a powerful statement in just 5 words. In verse 26, he says, "Then the sons are free." And then he goes on to say, "This is where you go, get the money, pay the tax." But do you realize what Jesus is saying there? In verses 22 and 23, we ought to mourn what we've done to Jesus, how much we have hurt Jesus. But then in verse 26, he's issuing an invitation. The sons are free. All the way up through this chapter, the emphasis has been on the Son of God. In the first section, verses 1 through 8, God says, "This is my beloved Son. Submit to him. Listen to him." And verses 9 through 13, Jesus is said he is the Son of Man, and he's going to be raised from the dead. Therefore, we anchor our hope in his resurrection. In verses 14 through 20, there was a man with an epileptic son that revealed the fact the disciples were not relying in the capital S son. And in verses 22 through 23, Jesus reveals what he is going to endure as he bears the pain of sinners. The Son is going to bear their pain, the Son of Man, in verse 22. And then in verse 26, he turns around and in just five words invites Peter, "Do you want to be free?" And I'm not talking about taxation. Do you spiritually want to be a son of God? Because that person is free. The burden and the debt of sin is removed. That can't be pegged to you anymore. And you think about some of the other passages that beautifully describe that. There's this great verse over in 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3. We'll back up. We'll just get the better context. Chapter 2 and verse 28. He's writing to disciples, Christians, and says, "Now, little children, abide in him, so that when he appears, we may have confidence and not shrink from him in shame at his coming. If you know that he is righteous, you may be sure that everyone who practices righteousness has been born of him. See what kind of love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God." There's another version in verse 1 that says, "See what kind of love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God." You know what that word "lavished" communicates? Abundance. More than enough. More than what's sufficient. Exceedingly abundantly, and we're starting to get into other Bible passages. You think about when your child is making a cupcake and they're getting to the icing and they just want to put more on and more on. They want to build up this really tall cupcake full of frosting. And you understand and they understand, "Mom, I want you to lavish that with icing. Just keep going." And what John is communicating over in 1 John 3 is that that is God's love toward us in the fact that we get to be his children through Jesus. See what love God has lavished on us, that we get to be his children. And so when you come back to Matthew chapter 17, and Jesus says, "The sons are free," he's issuing an invitation of sonship. You want to be that child that's not going to be spiritually taxed. Jesus, the Son of God, has the ability to make us God's children. It's through Jesus that we can be set free. And think about this. We get invitations to things all the time. We get invitations to parties, we get invitations to weddings, we get invitations to showers, we get invitations to any number of things. We understand that an unused invitation does not benefit you at all. You don't receive the benefit of the invitation unless you open it up and you RSVP and you show up. Jesus is offering us an invitation to become a child of God through his selfless sacrifice on the cross. And he's done everything that he can for that invitation to be legitimate. But unless we accept the invitation, unless we die with him in baptism, the invitation does us no good. If you want to be set free, you need to accept the invitation. And Jesus, according to this chapter, is more than qualified to issue it. Where are you this morning? Are you one of God's sons? Are you one of his daughters? The point is being a child. Are you one of God's children through Jesus? Have you accepted the invitation? Or are you letting it sit there unopened? If you have not yet died with Christ in baptism, do that. Accept the invitation. And if you have accepted the invitation, then understand you have chosen to submit your life to the beloved Son of God. And He's given you a future hope that you can bank on. Rely on Him for the rest of your life. Don't try to live your life on your terms and your wisdom. You let God and His Son direct that. And when you sin and cause Him more pain, repent of that, seek His forgiveness, and it's addressed. Because the sacrifice of Jesus is sufficient. If you need to accept the invitation this morning, please do that. Let us know by coming forward as we stand and sing.